you have to make mistakes, because that's the sort of edge of your seat drama that being in a band should be.
But I understand why people have terrible drug problems and alcohol problems, because a lot of the entertainment industry is finding out it's nothing like you thought it would be.
I had my battles with record companies back in the 80s and won the right to make the records I wanted.
I spent 10 years of my life with no money. Trying to get a record deal was so I was my own boss and I could do what I want.
Because you're altering the DNA of everything you've been listening to, altering it, bringing it up to date, modifying it, and turning it into a kind of higher art form.
I mean, we're all expected to be videographers and influencers and all of this at the same time, and I'm not any of those. I'm a songwriter.
For every Coldplay, there's 10 other Coldplays that all got signed in the same year. You know, yeah, there's a lot of broken dreams in the business.
I was nowhere. You know, I'd lost my record deal, massively in debt, and no obvious signs that I would ever be able to recover that, you know, because the career looked to be pretty much finished.
I was terribly ambitious, really, both in terms of getting on Top of the Pops, but also in terms of getting my vision to come true.
There is no formula to having a hit record. It happens, and it's probably 60% luck, 30% talent, and 10% timing.
Making a hit record is tough, but maintaining success is another skill entirely. On The Art of Longevity, we explore the artist's experience of the music business from the inside. I want to find out what separates those artists and bands that have survived decades in the music business from all those who've fallen by the wayside. We follow a narrative inspired by a quote from Brett Anderson of Suede, who said that all successful artists have followed a similar career arc, like stations of the cross. The struggle, success, excess, disintegration, and if you're lucky, enlightenment. With insights and stories for music fans, aspiring musicians, and creators, this is The Art of Longevity. The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. John Grant, welcome to The Art of Longevity.
Thank you, Keith. Thanks for having me.
How are you, John, and whereabouts in the world are you?
I'm okay, and I'm in Reykjavik. At my apartment.
My daughter actually just came back from Iceland. She was on a school trip.
Yeah, everyone's daughter just came back from Iceland.
You know, it was the classic stuff, I guess, the Blue Lagoon, the fjords. But she did tell me a fact. I said, well, I can check this out with someone who's going to know the answer. So she came back and she said, Iceland is the only country in Europe where there is no dialect. There's no variation in dialect. I said, okay, that's interesting. What does it mean? And we didn't quite get to the bottom of it. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, people say that, but when you're talking to Icelanders, they're always talking about how different the language is in the north. So it's not entirely, I mean, it's nothing like England, that's for sure.
And how is your Icelandic? Are you fluent now?
I don't feel like I know anything in Icelandic. I really don't, but it's still really hard to speak. They say that I'm doing a really good job, but I think they're lying. I mean, I've been here for 11 years and, you know, to be fair, I didn't spend most of my time here for those first 10 years, you know. I was always on the move. So it's a super difficult language.
But a great creative space for you. It's been really great for you since you moved there. Just tell me what you're working on at the moment.
I am working on my new record. I have this side project called Creepshow that I'm a member of, and we finished that record in October, and that's supposed to come out in June. That's just sort of slowly starting to appear now, various tracks from that. And then I went right into starting my sixth solo record, and I'm working on that now, and it's a difficult one.
I was doing some reading on your previous interviews, and there was an interview you did with Loud and Quiet a while back, and you said, in that, I have to remind myself how much I loved it when artists I love just do whatever the fuck they wanted, which is also a fantastic thing as a fan. And on this show, many of the guests are in that position. That kind of is the position you're in right now, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I really have no idea what position I'm in. People tell me that I'm a successful musician, but I feel like I'm still just sort of doing my first record. I've definitely built some sort of foundation, you know, since Queen of Denmark came out. But COVID really sort of, it felt like it changed the game. And, you know, Boy from Michigan, I keep being told that that was a success, but it didn't feel like it even happened. You know, it just came out and the reviews apparently were, I'm not really reading anything anymore. The reviews were supposedly decent, you know, on that. Well, quite good, actually. But, you know, I mean, it didn't change anything about my life, you know, and it felt like it didn't happen. I didn't get to, hardly got to do any shows surrounding it. And then when it was over, it was just like, all right, well, if you want to continue in this business, you know, where's your next record? And that was like, not even a year later. You know, I mean, you put your entire self into something. And then when you're done with it and you're feeling completely emptied out and completely depleted, you know, it's just like, all right, where's your next thing?
Yeah, I can imagine it is a little bit like that. It, you know, it's a very cyclical way to make a living in that sense, because it is from project to project. That's how the industry machine works. It's fascinating hearing you talk about knowing what success means. Just objectively, we've been looking at the success of all of the guests that are longevous in the business, and you are at this point. It looks like your star is rising. Your critical reviews are always good, but have been getting better. They were better across the board with Boy from Michigan. You were also charting in the UK, so you're in a point where you're creatively doing something that I think is, with Boy from Michigan, is groundbreaking, but also having commercial success. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it feels like you could be on the edge of something really big. That's how it feels to me.
Yeah. I've been told that for so long that was supposedly the case for so long that I can't think about that, you know. Even I can barely react to that statement, you know. I mean, there's a lot of pressure to just do like Queen of Denmark 2. But I mean, there is no Queen of Denmark 2 except that, you know, unless I come out with an album that says it doesn't really get better, you know. Nobody's going to want to hear that record.
Well, you could, though. Because there's been a lot of... You could go kind of more experimental, and many artists have done that. I mean, I think Solange did it, you know, after the success of Seat at the Table. She kind of self-corrected. She's like, I'm not into this. I'm going to do something that's kind of deeply experimental. So, you know, you could take it in different ways. I mean, do you have an essence to this new record that you could put into words?
It's basically about what I'm always exploring. It's sort of like going for the jugular vein as far as what it means to be a man and how I relate to people in the world based on the relationships to my mother and my father. So it's about, you know, like the mother and son relationship and the father and son relationship and the way that I relate as a man and the way that I relate to men and people in the world in general as a result of that. There's also little stories in there that don't really have anything to do with that, that are just stories that I find interesting. But sonically, I'm always trying to figure out how to marry, you know, the vibe of Blade Runner with, what was the word that I was looking at? Sorry, I'm trying to think of this word.
I was going to ask you how much Vangelis is an influence, because I hear that all the time. And Blade Runner is, you know, my cultural reference point. I mean, maybe that's why I like your music in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's going even more in that direction. It's like I was trying to think about, you know, I'm always thinking about Blade Runner because I love that sound so much, and I love those. I mean, it's sort of the way I sort of want it to sound is like somebody who's. Do you know? Here, let me just get this movie real quick. Are you familiar with this at all?
Yes, it's absolutely crazy. So Tetsu.
Yeah.
Yeah, insane stuff. I mean, I asked you about the essence, and I think it's really interesting that you pointed out two movies to capture the essence of an album. I think that's really cool.
It's funny. I don't really believe in writer's block, and I basically have all of the songs. I still have a lot of lyric writing to do. I guess that's the thing that's not bothering me right now, but it's taking a long time because I have to be in a space where I feel really inspired and really happy and really excited to write a lot of things, you know, and when I'm sort of sort of wading through difficult moments, it's hard to, well, it's just hard to be inspired so that those words come as freely as they can. You know, I sort of really need to be in the studio all day. And then, you know, sometimes I'll sleep on the couch. Sometimes I'll, you know, obviously I go for lunch or have stuff there to eat. And you sort of just need to spend the day there and sort of, you know, there's all sorts of things that you can always be doing. But some of these songs, you know, some of these songs sort of demand a level of specificity. Then there's phrasing and tone and register of the lyrics, you know, the like, what mixture or level of society are they coming from? Who's the character that's saying these words? And so what kinds of words do you need? And some of them are really big stories. And so my songs are always really long. That seems to be something that people always bring up. It's a problem, you know, like, but, you know, whatever, right? I mean,
yeah, bringing out long songs in 2023 when, you know, the sped up song is the thing. It's like a minute and a half, but you got to speed it up. No, I don't think there's a problem with that. To some extent, those stories that you're telling, they need to be epic in nature in a way. So you can't do that in a short song.
I sort of second guess myself a lot. You know, your story is uninteresting at this point. It doesn't matter. You know, everybody's got their own story. I feel like we live in this age, this sort of age of crushing toxic positivity, like fake positivity. And it's really hard to escape. And, you know, the people that know you your whole life, they're just like, oh my God, will you just fucking move on from your damn story?
The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Bowers & Wilkins makes some of the world's finest audio products, from the iconic 800 series loudspeakers, trusted by Abbey Road Studios for over 40 years, to the flagship PX8 wireless headphones. This is music as the artist intended you to hear it. These tracks that you've written, which are kind of, I don't know, it feels like deeply vitriolic against someone. I recognize it, and I kind of see it as therapy, listening to that stuff in many ways.
Vitriolic, what would you describe as vitriolic?
Well, if you look at a song like Portfolio, for example, and I don't know who that's aimed at particularly.
Well, because the problem doesn't go away, you know, and it continues to affect you. But I mean, from what I understand, the place that I'm supposed to be in right now, I'm supposed to be like Erykah Badu, you know?
In what way?
Well, you know, just ayahuasca trip. Everything's great. Everything's fine. You know, everything is a beautiful journey in a beautiful world. And I don't surround myself with negativity, and I don't manifest negativity. I'm a big fan of hers, you know, so I think she's absolutely fucking incredible. She's also one of those artists that sort of came onto the scene fully formed from her debut. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you actually if this next album was going to see you more in the Erykah Badu frame of mind, but I think from this conversation that's not happening. And actually, I don't think we'll mind a bit. Let's come on to Creepshow, because I assume you've had more fun with the Creepshow project, because it comes across as being fun.
Yeah, I mean, Yawning Abyss is basically the same stuff that we're talking about right here, because I guess what it feels like to me, and I guess, you know, you know, my point is, this is, you know, we've sort of brought this on ourselves because we don't want to have our lattes interrupted. You know what I'm saying? You know, we don't want to be inconvenienced, and nobody wants to believe that you might actually have to die for something. You know, that you might actually have to spill some blood to get things back on the right track. But I'm guaranteeing you that that's what it's going to take in the United States. I mean, it's completely out of control there. And, you know, this is expressed in, you know, it's fun. It's more of a fun way of expressing it on the Creepshow project.
Yeah, but it's still there.
Well, it's definitely there. I mean, I don't know how I cannot express this in the music that I'm doing. You know, you sit there and you think, you know, you brought up this song, My Portfolio. And, you know, people were in the reviews, there was a lot of people saying, at least my manager was telling me, you know, just people don't get why you would put a song like that on your record. It just seems stupid to them. And they, you know, they're just like, that's ridiculous to even have that on the record. But you seem to understand why it was on the record, you know, and it was, I thought it was one of the most relevant songs on the record.
Yeah. I also think it seemed to come in the right place in the record as well. I mean, in the way it was scheduled somehow.
Absolutely, because it's, you know, it's about how, like, you're expressing, or I personally am expressing, like, the tenderness and the quiet and the what it can be like to have a human experience, or my particular version of the human experience. And there's all this beauty in the world. You know, there's a song on there about the transforming power of friendship, of true friendship with people. But I mean, in today's society, you know, with what you see going on, I mean, doesn't that just sound ridiculous to you? The transformative power of friendship? I mean, who the fuck wants to hear about that? It sounds like something that an insane person would talk about, you know, in today's society. It's sort of a fight between, do I just make songs about whatever, you know, just like make cool music that sounds cool. And then at the end of it, just like make up, you know, just like whatever the vibe is of the song, like make up some lyrics and string some words together, which from what I can tell and from what I've been told directly from people is exactly what they do.
No, yeah, I don't think that's the way you write lyrics.
You know, it's not the way that I'm writing lyrics right now, because I'm sort of, I don't know. I think it's a fight within myself to just give in to, hey man, you could be really successful. You know, you could really take this to the next level if you just, you know,
hold back.
Well, yeah, just quit talking about your dumb story. And, you know, nobody gives a shit that you're gay. You know, nobody cares that you, you know, everybody struggled in their childhood. You know, it's, we're all the same. It doesn't matter. Now it's, everything's great. And, you know, you should, you know, if you want to take this to the next level, if you want people to like listen to you, you know, maybe get a Swedish producer to, you know, work on
it. Yeah, there's a few that come to mind. I don't know. I mean, you know, you're writing about all those things that are important to you and your life. And yeah, sometimes, you know, the politics and the vitriol, but you're hitting top 10 in the charts. So it's not that it's not working in that sense. What is back to where we started is it's about you got to do what the fuck you want. I think you're in that place. I'm interested in the collaborations. Creepshow for one thing, but also you've collaborated with many other artists. And I'm keen to know who you'd like to collaborate with. But when you do that, how do they bring a yin to the yang in terms of, you know, you want to write stuff that's personal to you and important to you? Are your collaborators kind of working with you more on the music side, or are they working with you lyrically as well or thematically?
Yeah, no, I don't work with people on lyrics, you know, because I feel like I've got that covered, you know? So basically it's about people helping me create the sound world that I envision and that I have, you know, a difficult time expressing. You know, it's hard to express exactly. You know, you can say as many times as you want, I want to marry Sonic Youth with Blade Runner and Evil Dead and Halloween 3. You can say that over and over, but it's like, you know, actually realizing that in the studio is a different thing. But I mean, for me right now, it's just a struggle of, it's like, it's a fight within myself to, do I just give in to what people are saying and make a disco record? Or do I just continue to be myself? And for, obviously the choice for me is I will just continue to be myself, you know, because when the world's in turmoil like this, I feel like you desperately want that comfort. And comfort that comes from financial security so that you can build your own little bubble and have your lattes and watch your movies and, you know, hang out with your friends and go visit the people that you want to, you know, go travel and do whatever you want. But I guess what I'm trying to do is just continue to be myself and challenge myself as well at the same time. You know, sitting with ideas and waiting for lyrics to come instead of forcing them to come is something that makes me very impatient, because, you know, you have the industry telling you, you know, you should have a new album out by now. I mean, Boy from Michigan was like 10 minutes ago for me, but I guess it was 2 years, you know, so it'll be 3 years until, you know, it'll be a total of 3 years when my next one comes out. But during that time, everything has changed, you know, so my financial buffer that I had when I went into COVID is gone, and you can't tour, which is what you, how you make money. You can't tour unless you have something new. So there's a pressure to create, because if you want to keep doing what you're doing without going back to waiting tables, you have to be on some sort of schedule. And then you've got the world saying to you, well, look at Lana Del Rey. She's not having any problems. She's coming out with a record every 6 months.
Yeah, and they're pretty damn good as well. And she is doing whatever the fuck she wants. But I hear what you're saying. There's a constant pressure to create. I mean, you know, I talk to kind of rising artists or artists wanting to break through into having a career all the time, and they have to release music all the time. You know, they almost can't stop. And so I think, you know, from that point of view, I think it's a deeply challenging time for creators there.
It's very difficult to just put yourself in this happy creative bubble. Well, at least it is for me. It doesn't seem to be for other people. You know, like Lana Del Rey, for example. I mean, how do you put out a new album every 6 months? The industry is telling me, well, we need a year to set up the record.
Yeah, that seems out of step with the times, I have to say.
Totally out of
step
with the times.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's what I'm hearing a lot of time from creators who are, you know, working with labels and working the label system. And I know you're on a cool indie label, but to some extent, indie labels are traditional in that sense. But, you know, it's a bit of a double-edged sword because I was going to say, I felt like with Boy from Michigan, that record has lasted. You know, it feels like it still has legs. You could still do something with it if you wanted to. I don't know what it would be. I know you've done some sort of intimate stripped down shows.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, what I'm being told is, I was talking to somebody about performing in LA recently, and they're like, well, we know the last thing he did was Boy from Michigan. What has he got now? Does he have anything new that we could, you know, that there could be a reason for him to come here? It's like, well, I didn't even come there for Boy from Michigan, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't present that album, but, you know, it costs £6,000 or $6,000 for a visa for one person to go to the States now. So obviously I don't need a visa, but if I want to take my band or my crew, I mean, the numbers are ridiculous.
Well, as you said, you know, the way to make a living is to perform live, but that seems to be becoming unviable for a whole swathe of bands that are kind of in the mid-tier of the business, if you like. Well, okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit more about Creepshow, because as you say,
yeah,
That's coming out, though.
I'm so sorry, yeah.
But, I mean, it's interesting in the context of what you're saying, sometimes those side projects are hugely important. I was introduced to it by a friend of mine who runs a show called Electronic Ears, which you'd love, by the way. And, you know, I think it was Yawning Abyss that I heard on a recent show, and I expected it to be more experimental or harder to access, but actually it's not. It's like Gorillaz, except it's better.
It's a little like pop treat. I mean, it is a fun... I mean, I get to work with, you know, one of my all-time heroes, with Stephen Malander from Cabaret Voltaire. I'm in the middle of touring all around, and... You know, and then there's a 1 week window that's allotted for me to write the lyrics, and Stephen comes to Iceland to do that, and you're just thinking, am I going to get it? You know, I'd wake up every morning sort of in dread. You have one of your all-time heroes staying with you and working with you, and he also happens to be like an incredible human being, so there's no weirdness or awkwardness or anything like that. It's just two peers working together, you know, which is unbelievable to me. I mean, it's sort of a dream come true for me. So there I would talk about success in my own life, you know, because I get to work with him, you know, and I get to know him. And then, you know, then you're getting up every morning. It's like you've got 1 week to write a song a day. You know, there's basically music, and there's already music in Creepshow. Some of it I worked on, but when I went down there to work for 2 weeks in June of last year, of 2022, I got COVID a couple of days into that stay. Or I mean, I had it when I went down there, and I was sick for the entire time. I mean, I was in bed the whole time. I had like maybe 4 days out of those 2 weeks where I was able to, and then everybody else got it down there too, you know?
Oh, God.
And so that 2 weeks was basically nothing. We had like two to four days where we actually were able to, where I was able to work on some stuff. And one of the things that I really worked on was Yawning Abyss. I mean, I created a song called, the music for a song called The Bellows, which is going to be on the new record. And then the rest of the music was stuff that the other three guys put together. And I loved all of it. So that was great for me. And so, you know, Stephen came for that 1 week in October of last year, we were doing the lyrics together. when it comes to something like Yawning Abyss, I'm the one that's singing on that, so I do the lyrics for that. And whatever he sings, he writes. So that's how it was. And every morning I'd wake up, you know, excited about it, but also just like knowing that you don't, that it doesn't just happen. You know, I mean, you have to put your best foot forward. You have to say, you know, I'm excited. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to do the best that I can. I've done this, you know, many, many times. So I know that I can do this. But then, you know, there are so many variables that are involved in creativity. It's a bit of a skittish creature. And you have to put in the time, and you have to, you know, what you get out of it might not be very good on a given day. One of the great things that I've heard from other musicians is something that Guy Garvey told me, and I think he said that somebody told him this. Whenever you're writing, you're just clearing out, you know, it's this pipe that things come through, and you have to just keep it flowing. So the good stuff comes from the same place, you know, and you have to get that other stuff out of the way on a day, say maybe that you're struggling with the variables of the creative process.
I heard that from Nile Rodgers on this show, actually, but I think it was Ennio Morricone who told him. So you have to write every day, you know, as a process. As you say, it's variable. But I loved that first Creepshow project. It felt quite light of touch. You know, it sort of comes across as being something that is away from the pressures of making, I guess, another John Grant record. And I assume as well that you'd learned a few tricks, electronic tricks, from Benj. But then he'd made the music earlier, so maybe not.
Yeah, not as much on this one because, you know, our schedules didn't really allow us to work together. And when we tried to work together, we all got COVID and, you know, it was a drag. But like I said, what the three of them did together, I loved so much that it was really not a problem. But yeah, it was less of me learning, you know, being in the studio. I couldn't really be there in the studio with them for the music part. And being in with Benj in his studio is one of the greatest things in the entire world. I mean, he's one of the greatest people I know, and he's an expert sound designer, you know, and he knows synths inside and out, truly like the back of his hand. So, I mean, you know, making the record Love is Magic with him was, you know, one of the happiest times of my life, being in that studio with him and Paul, the bass player from Midlake. That was really incredible. So, and then, of course, there's a fourth member of Creepshow who's Phil Winter, and he's usually on percussion duty. And so it is a lighter thing. I mean, there's a lot of levity and there's a lot of lightness to it, but it's also, I mean, it's got a nasty edge to it, you know. But this record, you know, cut back to what I was talking about of having that week to do all the lyrics for this record, and then that's it. And I just sort of, like I said, I woke up with dread every morning, like, am I going to be able to bring it? And I did bring it, you know, every day. It just sort of flowed out of me. By the end of that week, we were done with it, basically. So I was really pleased because I didn't know whether it was going to happen. All I could do was wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to show up ready and, you know, and do it.
Yeah. It's a contrast, isn't it, to the way you're working now and you're working on your own project because, as you say, creativity ebbs and flows, but when you've only got 2 weeks to get it done, it's kind of interesting to be in that situation.
There are definitely days when I go into the studio and just stare at the wall, and that has to be okay. I mean, I have so much equipment that I don't know well, you know, that there's always stuff to do. There's always manuals to be read. There's always sound finding, experimenting on all these different synths that I have and finding sounds and cataloging, you know, them and writing them down so that you're able to access them easily. So there's all sorts of things that you can do. You know, if you're not feeling it on the lyric front, or if your mind and your heart isn't, like, there's a lot of songs on this record that are difficult, you know, thematically. And they're difficult spaces to inhabit because they're painful, you know, and so I'll work on the sounds then, you know what I mean? So I guess the Creepshow thing was like, I didn't really have to worry about the sounds as much. You know, I got, during that time I was down there, I got to do one, I basically built one track from scratch, which was The Bellows. and added a bunch of stuff to what would become Yawning Abyss. This sort of synth riff that's over the top of that, which is like almost way too optimistic for my taste. You know, but that's what came out of me. Because at the end of the day, I am a very optimistic fellow, because I keep showing up and keep, you know, working at how to show up. So yeah, at the end of that week, it was finished, and now it's going to come out in June.
Have you talked about playing live? I don't know if you did it with the first record, actually. Did you do any live stuff together?
We did a few shows, yeah.
Okay.
And we're going to be doing like 7, 8, 9 shows with this one too.
Okay, great.
Over the summer. And, you know, we'll be going into rehearsals for that. I can't remember when that is, but so yeah, June and July will be Creepshow. Album, like I said, the album comes out in June, and the single Yawning Abyss just came out. And there's another one called Bungalow that's going to come out either today or Monday. Yeah. And that sort of sounds like, that sounds like one of those beautiful ballads from Yellow.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's Safe and Sound, isn't it? The closing track of the first record. And it's almost like a Scott Walker or Frank Sinatra or something, but it just has a beat that comes in, you know, behind it. But it's a classic ballad, which is pretty cool.
And, you know, that's what this bungalow track is. It's sort of, I guess it's sort of what I wanted that one to be.
Thanks for listening to The Art of Longevity. I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. Please take a moment to rate the show, leave a review on Apple Podcasts if that's where you listen, and do spread the word. Also, you can sign up via the Song Sommelier webpage for our newsletter, artwork, and much more. Back to the conversation. I'm from Hull, and I wanted to ask you about the Icelandic Flux, because I missed it, by the way. I was on holiday in Greece, and I had major FOMO, but I kind of checked it out since and read a lot about it. It was a big success. I mean, would you like to do something like that again, curate a festival and kind of be at the center of an event in that way? I mean, it was obviously unique circumstances, because I think it was the European City of Culture year.
Yeah, I loved doing that. I mean, I had a lot of help. It's a big team effort, you know, that sort of thing. But I met some incredible people, and I really, yeah, it was a wonderful experience. And there were so many great artists. You know, speaking of that, it makes me feel like if I could cry, I'd want to cry over the death of Prince Polo, you know, who took part in that festival and was one of my favorite acts at that festival. He's one of the greatest things to come out of Iceland. And anybody that doesn't know Prince Polo's work, I mean, if you don't speak Icelandic, you're fucked. But I don't really think you need to understand the language to appreciate who he is. So, I mean, you know, Susanna Sundfer was there, who's one of my favorite vocalists ever. She's sort of a cut above the rest in this world of copies and knockoffs. You know, the Wrangler guys, which are, you know, when they're without me, they're Wrangler. They came up and did a DJ set, and then also played as well. And Ghost Digital, which is Einar Arup from Sugar Cubes, and this musician who goes by the name Curver, they came up and did a show. I mean, it was so incredible. And one of my all-time favorites from another Norway favorite, Lindstrom.
Yeah. Okay, you're making me feel the FOMO all over again. I mean, I was reading accounts of people dressed up as you as well, which is just so typical Hull. I just fucking loved that.
Well, I love Hull. You know, every day that I don't get to go to Thieving Harry's in Hull is like another small death, you know?
It has a very strong ties with Iceland, obviously. I mean, my dad was a Hull trawlerman before the Cod Wars. So I remember that time as a kid.
I mean, it's an incredible place, and I won't hear anything different from anybody. It's really, I mean, I find it visually beautiful too. I find it striking. It's incredible. The people there were so lovely. I mean, it was great. I have a very, very special place in my heart for Hull, because it also birthed, you know, another one of my favorite things in the world, which is Throbbing Gristle. And, you know, later the music of, you know, Cozy Fanny Tootie and Chris Carter as Chris and Cozy, which, you know, at least one of their albums is on my top 10 of all time, you know.
Which one?
Well, it's Chris and Cozy's Exotica, an electronica masterpiece.
People don't think of Hull as being somewhere on the avant-garde, but yeah, they can get there occasionally.
Oh, I mean, it's incredible. You know, like Sheffield, it's one of the musical centers of the universe for me.
This is when I'm proud to be British, is when we welcome musicians like you into our world, because there's something about British culture and also those northern towns, those great northern industrial towns, where we kind of welcome in the weird and the alternative.
Yeah, and not in a way of like viewing an animal in a cage at a zoo
not at all. It's like a welcoming,
with loving
way.
Open arms.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely. And there were, you know, again, back at the festival, I really loved these accounts of you just mixing and mingling with the audience, because you can do that there. You couldn't do it in London, probably.
No. Well, I mean, it's just harder. Logistically, it's sort of impossible, you know? But, you know, it was a great experience, I have to say. So, yeah, I mean, based on my experience with that, I'd love to do it again, you know? I mean,
I'm wondering if you could do something like that in Reykjavik.
I wouldn't want to do it here.
Okay.
I'd want to do it somewhere else. Yeah, they don't need me here. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation, but...
Okay. John, I have one other question I was dying to ask you, which is another quote, which has kind of changed my perspective on live music a lot, because you said, this is the quote, "I didn't know when you write the songs and you record them, you haven't learned to sing them yet. You learn to sing them on the road," which I think you quoted in a conversation with Elton John. I read it in The Observer, which has really changed my enjoyment of gigs to some extent. You know, I've sort of discussed that concept with a lot of people on the show. Because I'd always assume singers nail the version they want in the studio and then try and replicate it live. But just tell me more about when you discovered, no, actually, you really learned the song after that process.
After you see the way that you're performing it live, after, you know, several months, it's so much better than the vocal performance you did on the record. Because, I mean, for me, I'm just trying not to fuck up. I have to sing something a million times. You know, I'm not one of those one take wonders. And, you know, maybe it's because I don't do it enough. I don't know. But there's so many variables and nuances to the performance of a song. I find it very difficult to be in the studio. I much prefer the live experience. I don't know. There's something very difficult about the pressure of having to get it right that I find very difficult when doing it in the studio. And then there's all sorts of difficulties with finding the right mix so that you can sing in tune with all the bass you got going on. And for me personally, I really feel like I don't really ever sing the song correctly until I've been performing it live for a while, you know?
Yeah, it makes total sense, but it came as a revelation to me at the time. But it does make sense, because I guess when you're in the studio, you have all those variables. It can only be one version of what it could have been.
Right. Like when I listen back to Mars off of Queen of Denmark, I'm just like, oh boy, I could have done so much better. But that's not fair, you know, that's not fair to say. I mean, it is what it is, you know, it's a moment in time, and that's just as valid as that moment that you do it in the live setting, you know what I mean? I try not to judge it, but a lot of times I look back and I'm like, oh, I should have done this, or I should have done that, or oh, I should have sang it 10,000 more times. You know, when I'm writing a song, I just want to record it. I don't want to sing it 600 times before I put it down. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah, it's just... totally get it. You'd risk getting fed up of it by that point, I would think. But no, it's really transformed my experience of gigs, because I'm always kind of listening out for it now. It's ruined the records, though.
Well, it's funny, you know, because I will always, you know, people make fun of me for loving Bowie's Let's Dance so much. You know, but when I hear live versions of Let's Dance, it's cool and everything, but nothing beats that recorded version for me.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Okay, one last thing. The design work on your record, on all your albums, is, again, just satisfyingly odd, pleasingly weird. Who do you work with on that stuff?
I worked with Scott King on the last two, and I worked with Anton Kaldal Augustsson on the third one, and Michael Berman, who was doing photography on that.
That was on Grey Tickles.
Yeah. On Pale Green Ghosts, I can't remember who was doing it was this Swedish woman who was doing the graphic design on that, putting things together. But I would say that I designed that one and put it together and just sat with her, and she did what I can't do because I'm not a graphic designer. And I worked with a photographer by the name of Hörður Sveitsson here in Iceland. And then Queen of Denmark was my friend Melanie Little in Texas.
Okay.
She did the graphic design on that for me. And those were all my photos. Once again, it's usually my photos, except for maybe the cover shot, but Queen of Denmark was my own photo as well.
Yeah, it's very symbiotic with the music. It sort of, you know, it gives you the strangely beautiful concept. It's, you're invited into, I think, a different world with your records, both through the graphics and the music. Is that part of a manifesto in a way?
Oh, for sure. For the last two records, I've had books of my photos that go along with the record or as part of the artwork. And yeah, I mean, it is so part of it. I mean, I feel like my records look pretty good. Although I'm not really crazy about the font on the front of Queen of Denmark, which is why I changed it. So some of them have a totally different font on them because I'm really a fan of drawn fonts. And I really love the 70s, you know, when it comes to fonts and drawn fonts. So although the 90s, you know, had gems like, I mean, you couldn't fault PJ Harvey or Portishead. Their album artwork was always pretty incredible. And Mazzy Star, and there were a lot of great ones. And Björk.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, it was the age of the CD, so everything had gotten smaller. The 70s work of, I mean, that's like the Hypnosis catalog. Have you seen that?
I'm sure I have, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's when they used to spend, you know, $50,000, $100,000 on a piece of art for an album cover. And like Hypnosis was the agency that did it. Yeah, so they did 10cc. They did the Roxy Music stuff, the Pink Floyd stuff, UFO, all that stuff, which I think is making a comeback. I mean, in a way, you're doing your version of that. And I think, you know, it's partly vinyl, but also partly the visual world that we live in. I think it's a great thing.
Thank you. I mean, that is hugely important to me. It's almost the most important thing to me, you know, like, you know, the font and the design and the photography and the art, whatever. I mean, Sonic Youth does incredible stuff too. You know, they've always got these artworks. You know, I have all sorts of books of, you know, album artwork that I'm constantly pouring over to, you know, try and figure out, you know, what it's going to be like. Björk's stuff, you know, her album covers are, you know, they never disappoint.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's really, you know, it's part of the excitement of seeing new music from someone like Björk. That's like the whole package.
The Art of Longevity is recorded at Cube West Studios in Acton and sometimes at the Cube East Studios in London's Canary Wharf. Cube is the world's first members studio for musicians, podcasters and content creators, and it's a real sanctuary for London's independent, inspired creators. It's a real pleasure to record the show here.
Even though I do this show because I'm interested in the creative process, particularly how it's longevous, because it ebbs and flows, not just day to day, but, you know, from decade to decade, I get a sense of there is a pressure. It's not just turning on a tap and creating, which I think a lot of people feel that's the life of a musician. It's like, okay, that's your job.
You know, like for Lana Del Rey and everybody here in Iceland, it just, you know, they're just super relaxed and don't care about anything. But as far as I'm concerned, they're not living in the real world.
That's interesting. I mean, because I think what's amazing about Lana Del Rey is the quality of those records. It's just, I mean, especially the new one, Tunnel Under Ocean Boulevard, which I think is the best thing she's ever done.
Oh, wow.
But it comes off the back of, you know, one that was, you know, Blue Bannister 6 months ago, as you say.
Yeah.
I guess she's still in the first half of her career. And there's something that is just pouring out of her. But there will be a time when I guess she goes through a period where that's not happening. And I think that's just, it'd be interesting to see what happens.
I mean, what number album is this for her? And somebody who's been on the scene for maybe how many years? Maybe 10 years?
Yeah, 10 since Video Games. Yeah, maybe it's 10 or 12, something like that.
Yeah. Is she doing that alone? You know, I mean, how do you...
No, I mean, there are so many producers on this new record. And of course, she's collaborating with people as well. So I don't think she's doing it alone, but she's driving it, obviously. You know, it's you know, she's controlling what she wants to do. Yeah, I think it's incredible.
It's going to be great. It's going to be beautiful. But I don't really know how to be anything other than what I am. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think a lot of it's once you've made your records, it is in other people's hands, right? I think it's the people you work with. It's the, you know, your label, your management, their teams. You have to let them do their job. But it's very interesting because I ask people, you know, when they feel they cross the Rubicon in that they can keep on making records and not have to go back to waiting tables. I feel like you've got there, but then what you're describing is it's still a pressure to do well enough to make a living. And it's a position a lot of professional musicians find themselves in.
You know, I'm being pressured to like become an Instagram personality, to become an influencer, because, you know, I'm being told, you know, you can't survive in this business unless you do this now. So it's now there's this new thing that I have to do that I have no desire to do.
It's very dangerous though, because I think once you succumb to, you know, creating that type of content, I don't know how you find time to make the records and make them as good as they can be, not in a sustainable way. I know why you're being asked, because there's a pressure on behalf of those who are marketing your record to have the same sort of content that others are working with.
Right.
To me, it's I think it's something to resist.
I think so too. I mean, I could become a comedian on Instagram, but I'm trying to do this other thing, you know, of like creating music. And the record's going to be great. It's just, it's a difficult process.
Who's producing it? Can you say?
Yeah, this guy, Ivor Guest. He did Hurricane with Grace Jones and Prohibition with Brigitte Fontaine, two of my favorite artists.
Yeah, amazing.
And he's doing Grace's current record that's going to be coming out soon. He and I are working together and it's going great and everything. It's there's a lot of beautiful ballads on it. And then there's a bunch of really funky shit because I needed to funk out. I definitely won't give up.
Definitely don't give up. I think you got to get through it. And I look forward to hearing it. And there's a lot of people out there would look forward to hearing it, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's up to you. You can do whatever the fuck you like. I've loved the conversation and I wish you all the best and I can't wait to hear the record and the Creepshow one. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you, Keith. It's been a pleasure, man. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, John. Bye.